Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Summer of Dash Pass is here. Get more to your door for less. Groceries, self-care, and restaurants. Subscribe to save up to 50% off your order. Plus, no delivery fees with Dash Pass from DoorDash. Start your 30-day free trial now. Terms apply.
You're listening to the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Oliver Conway. We're recording this at 13 hours GMT on Tuesday, the 4th of July. At least 7 people have been injured in a car ramming in the Israeli city of Tel Aviv. The Palestinian group Hamas says it was a response to the Israeli army raid in the West Bank town of Jenin. We have the latest. The UN Nuclear Agency backs Japan over its plan to release wastewater from the Fukushima nuclear disaster into the Pacific. And rights activists have condemned a brutal attack on a Russian journalist in Chechnya. Also in the podcast, Kenya's parliament may debate introducing the death penalty for homosexuality. And later,
will people be happy to jump to a Mark Zuckerberg production to escape the clutches of an Elon Musk Twitter?
Can Meta's new app poach users from Twitter? Even as Israel continues its huge raid against militants in the Palestinian town of Jenin, which began on Monday, bloodshed has been brought to the streets of the Israeli city of Tel Aviv, some 100 kilometres to the southwest. At least 7 people were injured in a suspected car ramming and stabbing attack. Footage from the scene showed a vehicle that had been driven onto a pavement near a bus stop with a number of bodies lying on the ground. Police said a terrorist had been neutralised, adding that the suspected assailant was believed to be a Palestinian from the occupied West Bank. That is where the Israeli military has been carrying out an extensive military operation against Palestinian militants in the Jenin refugee camp. The UN says it's alarmed by the scale of Israel's attacks there, including the use of airstrikes against densely populated urban areas. It said 3 children were among the 10 Palestinians killed. Israel says its mission there is nearly complete. I got the latest on that and the attack in Tel Aviv from our Middle East correspondent, Anna Foster.
It's a really fast-moving situation, but what we have seen is pictures from the street of Tel Aviv, really graphic pictures showing people who'd been rammed by that car lying in the street receiving medical attention. Several of them we know have been taken to hospital for treatment. The attacker we know has been shot, and again, looking at some of those extremely graphic pictures that are now circulating, it would appear that that attacker has been shot and killed.
Now, the Tel Aviv police say the attacker was a Palestinian from the West Bank. You are, in fact, on the other side of Israel, over at the West Bank, covering that Israeli operation against Jenin, which they said was to root out militants there. What is the latest from Jenin?
Well, I'm on the line between the two, right at the West Bank barrier, overlooking Jenin. And in fact, even as I'm speaking to you, I can see 2 faint plumes of grey smoke slowly moving into the air. And this is a scene that's really been repeated since yesterday morning. It's one of the biggest military operations to be launched in the occupied West Bank in many, many years, not just in terms of the scale, the number of troops that have been committed to this, but also in terms of the duration. We're well into the second day now of this operation, and it is continuing. Now, Israel's national security advisor gave an interview to an Israeli radio station this morning saying that troops were getting close to achieving their stated aims from this, that they wanted to send a strong message to Palestinian militants who were operating inside Jenin, and also really to dismantle their infrastructure. They've talked about finding caches of weapons and making those safe. They say that they believe that they are perhaps in the closing stages, but it's important to say they never put a timeline on this. They never said how long it will take. So until that operation is formally declared as ended, we see it continuing.
Now, Jenin is a refugee camp, but it's grown and developed over the years, so it looks more like a town, very densely populated. And the UN says it's alarmed at the use of Israeli airstrikes in that area. I mean, what is life like for civilians during this Israeli operation?
as you say, this refugee camp is densely populated, very narrow streets, and as well as the militants, there are many, many thousands of civilians who live there, women and children. And in fact, we saw several thousand families leaving yesterday evening once it got dark, people leaving in cars, leaving on foot in some cases. And Israel has really, I think, been reminded of its responsibilities by the international community, by the UN, certainly also by the US yesterday, the US State Department, saying that while they supported Israel's right to defend itself against terrorist groups, as they put it, that the protection of the many, many civilians living in this camp was of the utmost importance, and it was something that Israel really should keep at front of mind throughout.
Anna Foster reporting from the West Bank Barrier. An award-winning Russian investigative journalist and her lawyer have been injured in a savage attack from armed assailants during a trip to Chechnya. Yelena Milashina is in hospital, having had all of her fingers broken. She also has bruises all over her body and her head has been shaved. Her lawyer is said to have been stabbed. I heard more from our Eastern Europe correspondent, Sarah Rainsford.
Well, this, the way it's described, sounds like a particularly brutal attack. And we've seen images of Yelena and of Alexander Nyamov, the lawyer, and they both look in a pretty bad way, certainly. And the description that we've been given, both I've heard, actually, Yelena talking on a video that was recorded and posted online, but also from the Committee Against Torture, who has documented what's happened. They've described her with broken fingers on both hands. She's got huge bandages going from her fingers all the way up her arm. Her face is covered in zelenka, which is a bright green antiseptic, which is used often in attacks against activists in Russia. It's also used in hospitals, but in this case, it does look like it's been sprayed in her face. Alexander Nyamov has a knife wound. He also has bruises to his face. And when you hear Yelena speaking in this video, she talks about how their car, that they were taking a taxi from the airport in Grozny in Chechnya, they were surrounded by men in masks, armed men. They came in, they kicked the taxi driver out, she said. They then tried to tie her arms behind her back. They put the two, the couple on their knees. They put guns to their heads and they threatened them. And she said, the one thing she said, which is curious, she said they were very nervous as they were doing all this. It seemed like they were in a hurry, but still an absolutely traumatic, of course, attack on these two, a lawyer and a journalist who were in Chechnya to attend a trial of the mother of a human rights activist, several human rights activists, in fact, and critics of the leader of Chechnya, Ramzan Kadyrov.
And should we assume that this attack was an attempt to silence them?
Well, they were told quite clearly that this was a warning and that they should get out of town, essentially. Yelena Milashina has had multiple death threats over the years. She's an extremely well-known investigative journalist, and she particularly focuses, or has focused a lot in the past, on human rights in Chechnya. And that is a huge, deep and very dangerous topic to be digging into. So I would say that it's fairly clear that she has been warned off being in Chechnya. And I've spoken to her many times in the past. She's always kept going back, despite knowing very clearly the threat to her for carrying out her work.
Our Eastern Europe correspondent, Sarah Rainsford. The 2011 Fukushima nuclear disaster in Japan, which was triggered by a tsunami, is generally seen as the second worst ever after Chernobyl. 12 years on, the cleanup operation continues. The plant's operator wants to release the more than 1 million cubic metres of contaminated water there into the sea. And a few hours ago, following a safety review, the plan was approved by the UN nuclear watchdog, the International Atomic Energy Agency, and its boss, Rafael Grossi.
Today, I can say that the plan, as it has been proposed and devised, is in conformity with the agreed international standards. And its application, if the government decides to proceed with it, would have negligible impact on the environment, meaning the water, fish and sediment.
However, China and other countries in the region have expressed strong opposition to the plan, as has Japan's fishing industry. I asked our Japan correspondent, Shaima Khalil, what she made of the comments from the boss of the IAEA.
I think they're going to do very little to appease regional anxiety, but also to comfort the fishermen that you were talking about. I was in Fukushima a couple of weeks ago, and I spoke to fishermen, and they're saying that the release of this water is to them equivalent to a second disaster. It's taken ages for them. It's taken years for them to get back on their feet, to be able to put their fish back on the market, to go out into the sea. And again, more than a decade later, there's still stigma attached to Fukushima fish. They're nowhere near the money that they were making before the triple disaster in 2011. And they feel if this water is released, it's going to be a second disaster for them. It's going to set them back to square one. And I think, yes, Mr. Grossi is trying to reassure the public, reassure neighboring countries, China, South Korea, even the Pacific nations, who are also concerned that the environmental impact of this water is going to be negligible. Remember, this water is going to be treated. Most of the radionuclides are going to be removed. It's going to be diluted, then released into the ocean. As one scientist put it to me, even if they released all the water at the same time, it's going to be a drop in the ocean. But the reputational damage, I think the sense of fear that the words radioactive water in the ocean kind of conjures up is very, very strong.
Yeah, China says it's extremely irresponsible. I mean,
that's right.
Do you think it will happen?
I think it has to happen. I don't think that the Japanese government and TEPCO, the company that's running the Daiichi nuclear plant, have any other option. If you can imagine, this is water that has been piling up for years, and it's the water that's been used to cool the reactors. So it's picking up all this debris, it's picking up all this radiation, and it's been stored in more than 1,000 tanks, and it's sitting there like a ticking time bomb, right? And the problem is there is nowhere for it to go. It has to go somewhere because they're running out of space. And they need to do away with it. They need to pump it out. They need to release it in order to start decommissioning the destroyed reactors, in order to start pulling out the radioactive debris. And this is a process that they haven't even begun to battle with because it's so enormous. And they still don't know the enormity of what they're dealing with. But they say the most immediate obstacle, the most immediate thing, mission in front of us, is to release that water. And for them to start thinking about decommissioning the core element, which is the radioactive debris, they have to release that water.
And given that imperative, when might it start?
They're saying sometime this summer. They've been saying that for a while. But I think now that they have the green light from the IAEA, now that Rafael Grossi himself is here saying that it is in conformity with international standards, he himself is going to go to Fukushima tomorrow. He said that the IAEA will have a permanent presence. I think it's quite imminent.
Our Tokyo correspondent Shaima Khalil. Now, since he bought Twitter for $44 billion last year, Elon Musk has introduced a number of controversial changes. Now, Meta, parent company of Facebook and Instagram, is hoping to win over some of the disaffected Twitter users with its own app called Threads. So, how will it do? Matt Navarra is a social media consultant.
One of the big benefits to it is it's going to allow people to have a kickstart to their following because it'll bring in their connections they already have on Instagram. But effectively, it looks very similar and operates very similar to Twitter. And I think that's clearly very strategic because it wants people who join, who are coming away from Twitter, who are fed up with Elon Musk, to find something familiar and to take on what they've already started elsewhere. But of course, it also comes with Meta's baggage, which is its bad history with privacy and doing things that its users want them to do. So will people be happy to jump to a Mark Zuckerberg production to escape the clutches of an Elon Musk Twitter? Meta has this really poor track record, but then so do the likes of TikTok and a few others in this space. So they're all as bad as one another, it seems, at this point in time. In terms of competition, you could say that if it becomes more dominant and successful than Twitter and Twitter falls away, is that something that's of concern to regulators because it has even more of the social media pie? I think at this stage, it's too early to tell, but certainly people will have reservations about adding more data of theirs into Meta's servers. So that is a concern for them.
Matt Navarra, social media consultant. Now, are England's men's cricketers sore losers or were they robbed? Well, that is the question after the second Ashes Test match against Australia, which ended at Lord's on Sunday. The English batsman Johnny Bairstow was controversially dismissed, stumped after wandering out of his crease when it looked like the ball was dead. England fans were outraged, with some of the usually sedate crowd booing the Australians. Some even chanted cheats, no doubt a reference to the 2018 Australian ball tampering scandal. The British Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, weighed in, saying the Bairstow stumping was not in the spirit of cricket. But in response, Anthony Albanese, Australia's Prime Minister, said, "Same old Aussies, always winning." The British have long prided themselves on their sense of fair play. But does it really match the rhetoric? Mark Easton takes a look.
Britons above all other people insist on fair play. The words of Lord Baden-Powell, founder of the Boy Scouts movement. Fair play is an old idea of chivalry, he wrote, and we must always keep up that idea. Chivalry, of course, is a French creation, and the idea of fairness in sport was well understood in Roman chariot racing circles. Daniel Defoe was among the first to claim fair play was a distinctively English trait. He compared the anarchy of foreign street fighters with English brawlers who would never hit a man when he was down. The idea that abusing power was not cricket was at its height at the start of the 20th century, ignoring the ruthlessness that sustained the British Empire. A search of the term fair play in Hansard, the parliamentary record, shows a peak in 1911 when the political leaders of the day, Lloyd George and Ramsay MacDonald, were debating industrial unrest. The diving foreign footballer or the ball-tampering overseas cricketer are familiar tropes. And yet British sports stars are hardly immune to dishonourable behaviour. During the 1882 Oval Test match which created the Ashes rivalry, W.G. Grace ran out Australia's Sammy Jones when he left his crease to pat down the pitch, believing the ball to be dead. One wonders what Lord Baden-Powell made of that.
The always scrupulously fair Mark Easton reporting. Still to come on the Global News podcast, Indiana Jones is back in the cinema, but is it time to say goodbye to the franchise? The past few years have seen a number of African countries introduce or consider tougher anti-LGBTQ laws. Now the BBC understands that Kenya's parliament could soon start debating legislation that would introduce the death penalty for some homosexual acts. It follows on from Uganda's punitive Anti-Homosexuality Act, signed into law in May. Our Africa correspondent Catherine Bayaruhanga sent us this report from Nairobi.
Songs of praise as a dozen or so young people worship at the Cosmopolitan Affirming Church in Kenya. Roll-up banners displayed at the front describe it as an inclusive community that openly welcomes LGBTQ people.
God, as our Heavenly Father, knows us.
Gay sex is already banned in Kenya. But now what's called the Family Protection Bill, which seeks to further criminalise homosexuality, same-sex marriages and transgender people, amongst other things, has been submitted for consideration in Parliament. I asked the preacher how she felt about it.
Angry, extremely angry, disappointed. It makes people bolder. Anyone that had thought they would want to now do something to the queers, it gives them some sort of validation.
As people get ready to leave this church in downtown Nairobi, many will be thinking about their own personal safety. This church has had to move 10 times because of security threats. And now the stage is being set for tougher legislation that could make their lives even harder.
Parliament in Uganda has for the second time passed an anti-homosexuality bill.
Neighbouring Uganda passed one of the world's toughest anti-homosexuality laws earlier this year. It introduced the death penalty for some homosexual acts, for example cases involving a minor or someone with a disability. Some LGBTQ Ugandans have fled the country as a result, and there are reports of others being refused medical treatment or kicked out of their homes. The UK government said it was appalled by the law, and President Joe Biden threatened sanctions. But there is another possible American influence worrying gay rights activists.
We now join our colleague from Ghana via virtual.
Lawmakers from several African countries planning anti-LGBTQ laws took part in a conference on family values in Uganda at the end of March. The conference was co-sponsored by an Arizona-based Christian organization called Family Watch International. Here is its founder, Sharon Slater, speaking against what she calls extreme types of sex education.
It desensitizes children to sex. This is the pattern of all the programs that we analyze.
Like Family Watch International, several other American organizations campaign for what they call family values in Africa, focused around sexual rights and limiting access to abortion. Asked whether the meeting promoted anti-gay policies, Mrs. Slater gave this response to the BBC in a statement.
Family Watch opposes legislation that penalizes a person for having sexual attractions or for how they identify. Family Watch supports the right of African nations to determine their own values and laws.
I'm leading a very big team from Kenya.
Also present at the conference was the man leading the charge for anti-LGBTQ legislation in Kenya, the opposition MP George Peter Kaluma. He has drawn up a bill which could introduce the death penalty for some homosexual acts. This includes cases where someone becomes infected with a terminal illness like HIV.
We want to prohibit everything to do with homosexuality, which across the world goes under the alphabet LGBTQ+.
It's kind of wishful thinking in a way, that you'll be able to close the doors on Kenya, bolt the doors, and stop these ideas from ever existing here.
You know, to say that we should accept every nonsense from elsewhere is defeatist.
But at the Church for LGBTQ People in downtown Nairobi, people believe they have to fight for their right to simply exist.
It has not been easy. We do our work. We pay the bills, we pay taxes, so they have to accept us.
That report from Kenya by Catherine Bayaruhanga. China's embassy in London has accused Britain of openly sheltering fugitives, a reference to 8 pro-democracy activists who fled Hong Kong following the introduction of the draconian national security law in 2020. The British government has sharply criticised the offer of a bounty of $100 million Hong Kong dollars for their arrest, which was made on Monday. Hong Kong's leader, John Lee, said the 8 would be pursued for life. But the British government said it wouldn't tolerate attempts by China to silence individuals. One of the activists, Finn Law, says he's concerned for his safety.
It was indeed a surprise to me in the morning when I woke up.
Yeah, I mean, it was a surprise. Something you're concerned about? How do you respond to it?
Well, in the very beginning, it was a surprise. But in the end, I just realised that it's just the same warrant, something that happened again since 2020, because many of us, out of those activists, we have been wounded under the same draconian before. So in the end, we think, well, this is not really a surprise at all. And then perhaps it's because of our continuous effort or advocating for human rights, democracy, and some pragmatic policy to reduce the over-dependency on the Chinese market. So I would say that is perhaps the implication of the explicit bounty.
What about personally? I mean, does it mean you're going to potentially have to change the way you live your life? Is it something that raises the chances of you being taken to Hong Kong, ending up in Hong Kong?
Well, yes and no, because the risk of physical abduction or some kind of physical harassment escalate because of this bounty, because it's somehow encouraged people, or especially maybe some pro-Chinese Communist Party pinkies, are those people to do such of physical acts. So that is some kind of, I would say, transnational repression. And then on the other hand, personally, I would treat this as a badge of honor, because it somehow I enjoy the relative freedom of staying overseas. That's why I have to continue the fight for the Hong Kong movement, no matter whether voicing out on behalf of Hong Kongers, no matter with telling the world, especially those democratic countries, that's the painful lesson, the first-hand experience of Hong Kongers trusting the CCP back in, or maybe since 1970s.
What about those accusations then from the authorities that you and others are colluding with foreign forces, that you're endangering national security? How do you respond to that?
Well, this is a quite laughable accusation, because even though if we are just speaking to foreign media like BBC or even a number of NGOs like Amnesty International, we are already colluding with the so-called foreign forces. So that's why it's very fake. There are so many invisible red lines that we could not cross in Hong Kong or even outside Hong Kong because of the draconian national security law.
Hong Kong pro-democracy activist Finn Law. The Taliban authorities in Afghanistan are closing down one of the few remaining public spaces available to women, beauty salons. A spokesman for the Taliban Ministry of Vice and Virtue told the BBC they would be closed within a month. Women are already banned from working in either domestic or international non-governmental organisations. They can't attend secondary school, let alone universities, and are even banned from public parks. I heard more from our South Asia regional editor, Anbarasan Etirajan.
It's not unsurprising, but at the same time, it also shows how the Taliban are systematically working to squeeze women out of public life, as you mentioned. They have taken several decisions since they seized power in August 2021, like not reopening secondary schools for girls. And also late last year, they barred women from attending university and restricted women's access to gyms, parks and other public places. And if someone wants to travel beyond 72 kilometers, they need to have a male companion. And don't forget, there were thousands of women who were working in the government in the previous administration. They were sacked or working only in selected departments like health and education. So it also shows this kind of beauty parlors are, in a way, it's a gathering place. It's like a cafe for Afghan women where people meet and chat. So it comes as a big blow already. The job opportunities for women are very limited. And now by closing these beauty parlors, hundreds of women are going to lose their jobs. But the Taliban have not come out with saying, are they going to give any compensation? What are the business opportunities or livelihood opportunities for these women working in the beauty parlours?
Yeah, I mean, how many beauty parlours are we talking about? And are they concentrated in the major cities?
Most of them concentrated in the major cities. We are talking about dozens or probably hundreds. And they all started, opening these beauty parlours after the Taliban were driven out of power in late 2001 following the US invasion. And when I was in Kabul, I used to see, the very colourful billboards and the pictures outside these beauty parlours. And after the Taliban came back to power in August 2021, these eyes were basically, their faces were painted and all these billboards were taken inside. It was more like a very, very unnoticeable shop doing all these beauty parlor work. But now they have to close these shops despite operating very quietly. The Taliban say that because of the verbal order from their supreme leader, Haipatullah Khunzada, they were now shutting down. They didn't give any reason why they were being shut down, but they've given a month's time so that after that they will give their reasons.
Anbarasan Etirajan. The latest installment of the Indiana Jones film franchise, The Dial of Destiny, was released to great fanfare last week. But its opening weekend earnings were so low that analysts called them a disaster. So are we falling out of love with some of our favourite movie series? Harry Bly reports.
You stole it.
And then you stole it.
And then I stole it. It's called capitalism.
The Dial of Destiny is the fifth instalment of the Indiana Jones film franchise, and the latest to be released in 15 years, starring an 80-year-old Harrison Ford in his usual role, alongside Phoebe Waller-Bridge playing his goddaughter. It opened at number one at the US box office, but earned only $60 million in its opening weekend. And to put that into perspective, that's less than half of the takings of another recent film, Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse, another long-running franchise, which in its first weekend earned more than $120 million. It's a big drop too compared to the last Indiana Jones film, The Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, which came out in 2008. It grossed an estimated $101 million in the same period. So what made this film different to its previous installments and other franchise films? Stephen Gados is the executive editor of the film magazine Variety.
It is a franchise from way back in the 70s. It is set in a period of the past, although they've kind of dragged it into the present today. They have an 80-year-old star, which is an odd thing for a franchise blockbuster. I think if you look at films like Transformers or Star Wars or the DC Comics, you probably see a more consistent success because they're all so firmly rooted in fantasy and a more youthful cast.
It's worth mentioning that this is reportedly the most expensive film in the Indiana Jones franchise, as well as one of the most expensive films ever made. And this could be a factor too. Here's Stephen again.
Most of these movies are quite expensive. We're talking about hundreds of millions between the production budget and the marketing budget. But Indiana Jones is really exceptional. It's nearly a $500 million in production cost and marketing cost. So let's say they made it for a more reasonable $200 or $300 million. It would be a slightly less steep mountain to climb.
The executive editor of Variety, Stephen Gados, ending that report by Harry Bly. And before we go, Nick Miles has popped into the studio with a quick question for you.
Hello, Ollie. Next Tuesday, we are recording a special Global News podcast looking at the opportunities and the challenges presented by artificial intelligence. It's been in the news a lot recently, we all know that, with the hype surrounding the new generation of chatbots. But AI goes far beyond that, of course. It's already being used to create new medicines, revolutionise films, and find ways of adapting to global warming. Now, here's where you, the listeners, come in. In one sentence, we want to know how you would sum up your hopes and fears about AI. Just send us a short email, or better still, a voice note starting with your name and where you come from to the normal address, globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. That's globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. So just one sentence summing up your hopes or fears about AI. We'll have a panel of experts on hand to answer many of your questions at King's College here in London. Thanks.
And that is all from us for now, but the Global News podcast will be back very soon. This edition was mixed by George Baines and produced by Olivia Ataba. Our editor's Karen Martin. I'm Oliver Conway. Until next time, goodbye.